Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, U.S. media are abuzz with stories about the growing threat Iran poses to the U.S. The stories seem to embellish recent remarks by the U.S. Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, who says Iran is a larger threat than al-Qaeda and is prepared to carry out attacks in the Western Hemisphere, including in the United States. We'll be joined by Vijay Prashad, Director of International Studies at Trinity College in Connecticut, to talk about Iran. Also on the show, the New York Times series on working conditions at Apple suppliers in China, conditions that have reportedly driven as many as 20 workers to suicide, is disturbing and compelling. But is it the sort of work that leads to real reform or just journalism awards? We'll talk about Apple and coverage of Apple with longtime workers' rights advocate and researcher Jeff Ballinger. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll look back at the week's press.
With millions unemployed, wage stagnation for those lucky enough to have jobs, and an economy continuing to falter, it seems like a good time to call for more suffering, right? If you answered no, you might not be ready for the media big leagues, like NBC Meet the Press host David Gregory, who told Obama advisor David Axelrod on January 29th,
"If you look at how dire the fiscal situation is in this country, we just came off a debt debacle this past summer. Alan Simpson responding to the State of the Union said, where's the guts? Where's the hard stuff? Where's the beef? Where are the hard choices that Americans are going to have to make? What are Americans going to have to do with less of if this president gets reelection?"
Axelrod, to his credit, noted that plenty of people were hurting. But Gregory wasn't impressed. The NBC anchor spoke almost disdainfully of modest measures taken to reduce the pain. Quote, "Wait a second. There was a stimulus plan. There was a new health care entitlement. But there was nothing dealing with the big drivers of the day." Close quote. By that, he meant entitlements. He chided the White House for not following its own debt commission recommendations, which called for cutting Social Security and Medicare benefits. It's hard to overstate how committed elite media are to austerity as the fix to our current economic problems. Though economists like Paul Krugman and Dean Baker disagree, and the public actually think the hard stuff would be in cutting, say, the military, this doesn't get through to David Gregory, who thinks Social Security, a program with trillions in assets, is one of the big drivers of the debt.
Another call for more pain comes in Neil Ferguson's January 23rd Newsweek column, where he explains that while technocratic experts have the painful answers to our economic questions, by which he means more austerity, always more austerity, there's a catch. Those nerdy experts aren't always great at selling the policy. So how to do that? Quote, "People can tolerate job losses, spending cuts, and tax hikes if they believe that a payoff will come in the foreseeable future. How to persuade them of that? The only way is through political leadership." Close quote. Ferguson concludes that Americans, quote, "need to be convinced to swallow the bitter medicine that competent government sometimes prescribes." In austerity-stricken Europe, too, the populists are waiting in the wings, ready to deliver rabble-rousing rants. Perhaps 2012 will turn out to be their year after all, close quote. The problem with Ferguson's preferred austerity policies is not that they require sacrifices. It's that they don't work. The decisions to make people in Europe swallow the bitter medicine of austerity have actually made the situation there worse. As a recent IMF report acknowledges, the bitter medicine prescribed by the conservative-led government in Ferguson's native Britain has recently succeeded in making the economic crisis there worse than the Great Depression. Is that the big payoff a true leader would have persuaded them to believe in? Ferguson is himself an expert. His bio notes he's a professor of history at Harvard, a senior research fellow at Oxford University, and a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. That's always the problem with technocratic government. You have to be careful which experts you listen to.
U.S. government officials don't speak on the record about the CIA drone war in Pakistan. But that changed for a minute on January 30th when President Obama responded to a question about drones and civilian deaths. No, not a question from a mainstream journalist, but from a participant in a live web interview hosted by Google. The New York Times reported the exchange the next day under the headline, "Civilian deaths due to drones are not many, Obama says." That is what he said, but the Times could have pointed out, as they did last August, that the U.S. government's record on this issue does not inspire much confidence. The Times showed that CIA claims that zero civilians had died due to drone strikes were absurd, and the British Bureau of Investigative Journalism reported that the civilian death toll since 2004 could be between 391 and 800, including 168 children. The Wall Street Journal told readers on January 31st that U.S. officials cite a civilian death toll of 60, a number many in Pakistan dispute. The Journal also weighed in on the PR question, saying, quote, "Proponents of more disclosure inside the administration and the military argue U.S. secrecy has fueled charges in Pakistan that the drone strikes frequently kill civilians. They say releasing at least some details about the operations will help deflect criticism," close quote. It's good to hear the thoughts of anonymous proponents of disclosure. In any event, the White House told reporters it was going back to not talking about the drone war.
New York Times columnist David Brooks, who's been called the bard of the 1% for his defense of the economic elite, is at it again, telling people not to worry about the concentration of wealth at the very top of the income scale. Brooks writes in his January 31st column that the claim that America is threatened by the financial elite who hog society's resources is a distraction. Brooks argues, quote, "The real social gap is between the top 20% and the lower 30%. The liberal members of the upper tribe latch on to this top 1% narrative because it excuses them from the central role they themselves are playing in driving inequality and unfairness," close quote. Well, Brooks's claim then is that inequality is really a matter of the top one-fifth, not the 1%. That's not what the Congressional Budget Office says. Their numbers say that it's true what you might call the upper middle class has done better than the middle class and poor over the past three decades or so. Their income has grown by 65% versus 40% for the middle class and only 18% for the poor. But over the same time period, the income of the richest 1% has soared by 275%. That's close to quadrupling. And while the share of income claimed by Brooks's upper tribe has stayed about the same since 1979, the poor and middle class have gotten substantially less, while the piece of the pie taken by that 1% has more than doubled in size. Turns out the real driver of inequality and unfairness is the financial elite who hog society resources.
And finally, unlike reporters, columnists are encouraged to inject some personal voice into their writing. Sometimes, though, you wish it would be less personal, as in the case of syndicated columnist Kathleen Parker's enamoration with Mitt Romney. Parker's latest ponders why people are so reluctant to support Romney, quote, "despite his picture-perfect resume of skills and accomplishments," close quote. That's the thing. He's too perfect, which for Parker means he's so rich he never has to work again. His millions of investment income are barely taxable, and, quote, "when he looks in the mirror, he gets to rest his eyes on a relentlessly handsome face," close quote. Well, Parker's analysis, then, is that it isn't that Romney can't connect with the people, it's that people can't connect with him, which doesn't make much sense, but then she seems distracted.
Thank you, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
Talk about turning reality on its head. Recent news reports have been touting the increasing threat Iran poses to the United States. The alarms are sounding in U.S. media following a speech by U.S. Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, who said on January 31st that Iran was now a greater threat than al-Qaeda. He didn't mention where fluoridation ranks. And citing a plot to assassinate the Saudi ambassador in Washington by Iranian government figures, a Mexican drug gang, and a used car salesman in Texas, Clapper said Iranian leaders are now more willing to conduct an attack in the United States if they feel U.S. actions are threatening their regime. If Clapper's remarks were not alarmist enough, it seems the corporate media have made them even more so. Joining us to talk about all this is Vijay Prashad. He's the Director of International Studies at Trinity College in Connecticut. His new books, Arab Spring, Libyan Winter, and Uncle Swami, Being South Asian in America, are due out this spring. Welcome back to Counterspin, Vijay Prashad.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Vijay, before we talk about some of this fevered media coverage, let's talk briefly about the state of relations between Iran and the Atlantic powers, the U.S., et cetera, as you described them in your recent Counterpunch piece, Fingers Itch for a War on Iran. It's not exactly a state of peace now, is it?
Well, if you ask most of the 78 million people who live in Iran, they will tell you that the economic life in Iran has gone from pretty bad to appalling. The currency, the rial, has lost its value against the dollar by at least 70% over the last 28 days. And that is a scandalous state of affairs for a country which relies on imports, like most countries do, which is why anything in Iran now is highly inflated in its cost. And the reason the Iranian rial has gone into a free fall downward is because Iran has faced a series of economic attacks by the United States and Europe. And these economic attacks have had a direct consequence on the everyday life of people. You know, we call these attacks sanctions, but the word sanction doesn't carry exactly what, the effects are on people's lives. Secondly, there was, of course, the hoopla around the so-called plot to kill the Saudi ambassador. That sounded to me like more the fantasy of a very strange man who lived in Austin, Texas. But on the other hand, there have been actual assassinations taking place in the streets of Tehran. We have four senior scientists assassinated in broad daylight. And so these real attacks in Tehran have chilled the scientific community, have actually brought fear to many intellectuals, afraid to go outside, afraid to deal with their daily life. So if there is an actual war, an actual threat that is going on, it is already inside Iran. There is no real threat to the United States.
Well, in addition to what you've described, which some seem to qualify as acts of war, you also have somebody, probably the Atlantic powers, arming insurgents, running special operations. We had a huge bomb exploding at Isfahan that Israel has all but taken credit for. So there are these real acts of war that have been going on.
Well, yes, there have been explosions, and then there has been cyber warfare. The Stuxnet worm attacked the Iranian computer systems in 2010, and very recently the Iranians, I don't know how they did this, brought down by some kind of of computer of weaponry, they brought down a U.S. drone and landed it and put it on display in Tehran. So obviously there is ongoing conflict against Iran taking place. Now, what is quite scandalous is that in this case, we seem to think that it's acceptable for certain countries in the world to attack other countries and treat that as normal, whereas if a country makes even the smallest noise about, closing its territorial waters, that is then magnified as an enormous affront to the international affairs. You know, keep in mind that when the Iranians said that if you persist in these actions, we will close the Straits of Hormuz, the actual statement was, we will not allow ships to enter Iranian territorial waters. Now, it just so happens that the only side of the Straits of Hormuz that are pliable by big oil tankers is the Iranian side. The Iranians never said you cannot go down the Omani side. It just so happens that in Oman, the waters are far too shallow for big oil tankers. So the net effect of Iran closing its territorial waters, which is something it is allowed to do by international law, would close the Straits of Hormuz. But the way it is then portrayed is Iran is putting out an act of war. And I think that's a very duplicitous, perhaps even ignorant way of talking about the statements coming out of Tehran.
Well, over the last month or so, we've been seeing mixed messages from elites on an Iran attack. One week, there's news chatter about a possible large-scale attack on Iran being too costly or dangerous. But then at the end of January, there was Ethan Broner in a New York Times story quoting Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak saying it wouldn't really be such a big fuss. And the coverage this past week or so seems to indicate that at least the U.S. press is putting its combat boots on. One night, Brian Williams and Andrea Mitchell on NBC, and the next night, Diane Sawyer on ABC are touting the increased threat to the U.S. homeland from Iran. I'll give a couple of examples of that. You have Williams calling Clapper's testimony a chilling new assessment about the scope of the threat from Iran. And you have at ABC, Diane Sawyer saying, quote, America's top spy warns that Iran is willing to launch a terrorist strike inside the U.S., close quote. What do you make of this?
Well, firstly, one would have hoped that after the debacle of 2002 and 2003, and the kind of reporting that came out of particularly the New York Times, and in the New York Times it was Judy Miller, that these reporters would have at least, you know, developed some kind of mechanism for slowing things down, for asking the real questions. Secondly, I welcome them. I will give them a free seminar on how to read the Iranian media and how to read Iranian statements. You know, perhaps they need to understand that every single statement is not transparent, that people have different cultures of the way they say things, what they, you know, propose to mean, and also perhaps a quick lesson in geography, because it seems to me that they don't understand the part of the world they're talking about at all. So those two things said. The third thing, I think this talk about whether there'll be an attack or whether there'll not be an attack is extremely cynical and disturbing, and itself, you know, demonstrates to the rest of the world that we are becoming increasingly a people unconcerned about the wishes of people elsewhere. In other words, imagine if some part of the world, people cynically, dangerously say, well, now we've decided not to attack immediately. You know, we're talking about 78 million people. We're holding 78 million people of another country hostage to the kind of whims of our elite political class. And I think that is a moral question we need to ask ourselves, whether we want to have a political class that talks so cavalierly about the real lives of other people.
We've been speaking with Vijay Prashad, Director of International Studies at Trinity College in Connecticut, and the author of the upcoming books, Arab Spring, Libyan Winter, and Uncle Swami, Being South Asian in America. Thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin, Vijay Prashad.
Thank you so much.
The New York Times is to be credited for their current series of reports looking at, as one headline put it, the human costs that are built into an iPad, specifically the humans that work in factories in China that supply Apple. It's good for readers to learn about the underage workers, the toxic exposures, the generally demeaning and unhealthy conditions that Apple suppliers maintain and that management permits. At the same time, it's somewhat frustrating to watch journalists discover again and again, as for the first time, the cruelties involved in doing business for many major corporations. To see them be surprised anew that companies seem to care more about image than making real change. What's going on with workers' rights at Apple suppliers, and how can journalism be part of the solution? Joining us now to talk about the issue is veteran worker rights activist Jeff Ballinger. He joins us by phone from Washington. Welcome to Counterspin, Jeff Ballinger.
It's nice to be with you, Janine.
Well, it's not only the New York Times. This American Life just did a program on Apple suppliers in China. What do you make of this media moment on Apple, and how do you see the company responding?
Well, one of the best little pull quotes I read was, this is Apple's Nike moment. And that pretty much sums it up for me. It's going to be a moment. And that's unfortunate because we kept Nike under scrutiny for months. I would say really 2 or 3 years because the impact on their sales in the U.S. showed it, and it was mostly because of the bad publicity surrounding their sweatshop. So in a way, it's good that it's compared to Nike because the same issues are involved, but in a way, it fills me with some trepidation that it's just a passing thing.
When corporate media talk about sweatshops, there are a number of issues, but with the Time series, it's a bit ingenuous when you read something like, There is an unresolved tension within the company. Executives want to improve conditions within factories, but that dedication falters when it conflicts with crucial supplier relationships or the fast delivery of new products. I mean, I don't even know what the word want means in that sentence. You know,
it opens up this whole question of how much influence you do have over a supplier factory, especially when you're beating them severely on the price question. And when you're a bigger buyer, you've got more leverage. We've seen this when Reebok merged with Adidas. Their people were telling reporters, oh, yeah, we just had a fantastic quarter because we've got more leverage with suppliers. We're bigger. We're a bigger buyer. So what does that imply? That you can force the cost down. So don't tell me at the same time you're forcing costs down that you're really concerned, you know, about the conditions in these factories, because the two are incompatible.
Well, one of the Time stories ends with a source saying that there's really no real pressure on Apple to change because, quote, customers care more about a new iPhone than working conditions in China, close quote. Well, that's a big feature in coverage, and it's kind of a standard line from owners, but I'm sure many customers would say, well, they don't remember being asked about it. Now, of course, it's double-edged because you want to say consumers do have power, but what do you make of this? It's really consumers' fault that there are these, you know, 12-year-old girls breaking their fingers in China.
It's troublesome, and what wasn't really reported so much in that series was pollution at factories and, you know, how villagers have risen up and, you know, what can consumers really do to have an impact. I'm afraid, you know, we had our go, you know, with Nike, and we did show that if you focus on one company's operations in one country in particular, you can really hurt them. But I don't think consumers are going to be led by a group of organizations, because we did have a group of various organizations involved in the Nike campaign, and I don't see that developing. I hope I'm wrong. I hope that this can be a real full-fledged campaign. But what I've seen was a lot of letter writing, and these are the people, you know, we're going to get a petition with 250,000 signatures about the iPhone 5 or something. This is not going to get it.
You described the moment that Apple is in right now as being something called apology plus transparency. What's that about?
Well, you'll remember that Phil Knight at Nike was adamant at first. For almost 5 years, he said, look, this is the new global economy. All you critics are flat worlders. You know, get used to it. And then when sales started to fall for a couple of years running, he rented out the National Press Club in Washington, and he made this speech saying, you know, Nike has become synonymous with child labor and abusive conditions, and it was really pretty remarkable. And so was it, you know, was it a rhetorical device? That's what I'm suggesting, that you apologize. And then they quickly, after the National Press Club speech, you know, published a list of all their supplier factories. And that seemed to satisfy most critics. The critics were also kind of herded into this White House apparel industry partnership, which Bill Clinton organized, and that helped tamp down criticism. So it was a lot of different things. Because this was embarrassing to a lot of different people, not just Nike. I mean, Bill Clinton and his free trade policies and Robert Reich along with him, you know, said, well, you know, we've got to, you know, deal with this issue. And so the apology plus the transparency seemed to do it. This is corporate social responsibility, and it really kind of took off from that point at 97, 98, 99.
Well, when you say transparency, and in this case, Apple has released a list of suppliers, but not their locations, and it really is what I think I hear you saying is it's really could be just the beginning. In other words, this should be the beginning of the follow-through of making real reforms in those places instead of a time when we simply say, oh, look, they put the information out. That must mean, you know, everything's going to be better going forward, just automatically.
Yeah, well, this transparency part of it is you have to unpack this concept, because it implies that of these under-resourced NGOs, both Chinese and in the rich countries, can really do something with this list. Now, maybe they can, maybe they can't, but my hope is that, you know, we can partner with NGOs in China the way we did on previous campaigns, and really hold their feet to the fire, because what they also did was hire this Fair Labor Association, which kind of grew out of this Clinton White House partnership, and they've got just an awful track record. You know, they're more in the cover-up variety of NGO. I didn't even classify them as an NGO, really. But if we could put pressure on this Fair Labor Association with some real pointed questions in partnership with some NGOs in China, I think that's the way to proceed.
Well, let me ask you finally and briefly, as limited as the New York Times may have been in its ideas, we've already seen pushback, an article in Maclean's, just for one example, that's saying, you know, you have to consider what other Chinese workers make. Actually, these people at these Apple suppliers have it pretty good. We should expect more of that, probably, shouldn't we?
I think you'll see more of it, but we don't have to accept what's going on in these factories at all. I mean, consumers haven't been heard from enough. I think that we really need to demand not only transparency, but real change. And that's what I'm hoping can be sparked by this round of coverage that we've just seen. And, you know, sadly, the suicides 2 years ago didn't do it.
We've been speaking with Jeff Ballinger. His recent article, State of the Apple, Rotten, appeared on labornotes.org. Thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure, Ginny.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. FAIR also publishes a monthly magazine called Extra. You can get subscription information on our website. It's fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.